Nomoto presents American presidents. President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 29 minutes. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project, a guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. On a gray March afternoon in 1933, as a cold rain fell on Washington and banks failed across the country in a kind of slow-motion collapse, Franklin Delano Roosevelt rode in an open car toward the Capitol, his head high, his jaw set in that familiar, confident line. Around him, the city was tense. Unemployment had reached heights Americans had never seen. Breadlines looped around city blocks. Farmers lost their land. Factory whistles fell silent. In the weeks before the inauguration, the financial system itself had begun to buckle. State after state declared bank holidays to stem panicked withdrawals. By the morning of March 4th, the entire banking structure of the United States was functionally frozen. The man who rode through that storm was 51 years old, paralyzed from the waist down, supported by steel braces hidden under his trousers and refusing, absolutely refusing, to show even a flicker of doubt in public. The nation knew him as Franklin D. Roosevelt, but already, in the shorthand of ordinary people, his name was compressing into a symbol, FDR. He would serve longer than any other president, guide the country through the Great Depression and World War II, expand the reach of the federal government, redefine the relationship between citizens and the state, and leave behind a legacy that remains contested and powerful nearly a century later. To understand how he could become that figure, we have to go back to a very different world, to the Hudson River, to privilege, to a boyhood about as far from breadlines and factory floors as it was possible to imagine. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was born on January 30, 1882, at the family estate of Springwood in Hyde Park, New York. The Roosevelts were not just wealthy. They were embedded in that dense, interlocking network of East Coast families who moved easily between townhouses, country estates, and European tours. His father, James Roosevelt, was a gentleman of leisure, older, kindly, fond of horses and quiet conversation. His mother, Sarah Delano Roosevelt, was younger, forceful, and utterly devoted to her only child. To a degree unusual even for the era, she controlled his environment. Tutors instead of public school, carefully chosen friends, summers in Europe, all wrapped in a cushion of money and maternal attention. The boy who would later speak so easily to farmers in Iowa and unemployed machinists in Detroit grew up far from their worlds. He had his own pony before many children his age had proper shoes. Yet even in this sheltered environment, there were hints of what would come. Franklin loved ships, maps, and the idea of public service. He admired a distant cousin whose portrait hung on the wall, Theodore Roosevelt, the rough rider who had stormed into national politics with energy and reformist zeal. Young Franklin absorbed that example deeply. He saw in it a model. A Roosevelt could be both aristocrat and champion of the people. Education followed the expected path for a young man of his station. Groton, the elite Massachusetts prep school, introduced him to an ethos of Christian service and noblesse oblige, the idea that those born into privilege had a duty to use their gifts on behalf of others. Then came Harvard, where he edited the Crimson, cultivated connections, and tried on the mannerisms of leadership. In 1905, he married Eleanor Roosevelt, his fifth cousin once removed, and the niece of Theodore. Eleanor was shy, serious, and deeply sensitive. Her childhood had been marked by loss and neglect. Franklin's had been smoothed by wealth and adoration. Their marriage created a partnership that would evolve, strain, fracture, and, in a complicated way, ultimately deepen, as both of them grew into roles neither had fully anticipated. After Harvard and a brief stint at Columbia Law School, Roosevelt entered New York politics as a Democrat, an unusual choice in a family more inclined toward the old Republican establishment. In 1910, he won election to the New York State Senate, representing a largely rural district. He brought with him the name, the charm, and the progressive instincts that echoed his cousin Theodore's earlier crusades. He opposed the Tammany Hall machine that dominated New York City politics, aligning instead with upstate reformers. Tall, good-looking, and buoyed by family money, he seemed to many observers like a younger, slightly smoother version of T.R. His rise was quick. In 1913, President Woodrow Wilson appointed him Assistant Secretary of the Navy, a post that Theodore Roosevelt himself had once held. Franklin reveled in the job. He loved ships, the sense of national power embodied in steel hulls and naval bases. During World War I, he threw himself into expanding and modernizing the fleet, improving efficiency, and pushing for a larger American role on the world stage. He toured battlefields, inspected bases, and began to dream of higher office. By 1920, at just 38, he was the Democratic nominee for vice president on a ticket with James M. Cox of Ohio. They lost in a Republican landslide. Warren G., Harding's promise of normalcy, overwhelmed Wilsonian idealism and the Cox, Roosevelt ticket. For most politicians, such a defeat would have meant regrouping, perhaps waiting for another opportunity. For Franklin, it coincided with a more intimate catastrophe that would change the course of his life more profoundly than any election. In the summer of 1921, while vacationing at Campobello Island off the coast of Maine, Roosevelt fell ill. At first, the symptoms seemed like a bad cold or a touch of the flu. Then came the fever, the pain in his legs, the numbness, the terrifying loss of strength. Within days, he could no longer stand. Doctors eventually diagnosed him with poliomyelitis. For a man who had built his public image on vigor, athleticism, and the Rooseveltian ideal of strenuous life, the blow was immense. Polio left him permanently paralyzed from the waist down. The disease took not only his mobility, but also, potentially, his political future. The unspoken assumption in American politics was that a leader must appear physically robust. Roosevelt refused to accept the idea that his public career was over. He embarked on a long, arduous process of rehabilitation, exercises, braces, swimming. Warm springs in Georgia seemed to help, and he eventually purchased a rundown resort there, turning it into a therapy center not only for himself, but for other polio patients. Polio hardened him. People who had known him before and after the illness often remarked on the change. The earlier Franklin had been charming but somewhat glib, a man to whom things came easily. The later Franklin was more focused, more empathetic, more capable of understanding suffering that he had never personally experienced before. Confined to a wheelchair, he learned what it meant to navigate the world with vulnerability and dependency. He also learned how to manage perception, how to stand with the help of braces and a strong arm, how to appear upright while giving speeches, how to frame himself in photographs so that the paralysis was invisible. The public knew he had been sick. They did not fully grasp how disabled he remained. Eleanor, meanwhile, was undergoing her own transformation. The strain of Franklin's affairs, most notably with Lucy Mercer, her social secretary, had wounded her deeply. Their marriage, in any conventional romantic sense, never fully recovered. But instead of collapsing, Eleanor channeled her pain into public work, settlement houses, women's organizations, advocacy for the poor and marginalized. Over time, she became Franklin's eyes and ears among groups far outside his Hyde Park milieu. Their relationship shifted from husband and wife romance to something stranger, but in many ways more powerful, a political partnership, sometimes tense, often out of sync, but grounded in a shared sense of responsibility. By the late 1920s, Franklin Roosevelt had rebuilt his political base. In 1928, he ran for governor of New York and won, narrowly, in a year when the Democratic presidential nominee, Al Smith, lost badly. As governor, Roosevelt experimented with policies that would later become national. When the economy faltered after the 1929 crash, he expanded state relief efforts, supported public works, and began to articulate a philosophy that went beyond the old laissez-faire assumptions. Government, he argued, had a positive obligation to ensure a basic level of security for its citizens. In 1932, with the Great Depression deepening, the Democratic Party turned to him as its presidential nominee. His campaign promised a New Deal for the American people, a phrase deliberately vague yet suggestive of change. He attacked the Hoover administration for its failure to bring relief, hammered on the themes of action and experimentation, and used radio to speak directly to voters. The result was a resounding victory. Roosevelt carried states that had been solidly Republican for generations. Desperation, anger, and hope combined to create a mandate unlike any in recent memory. And so we return to that rainy March day in 1933, to the moment when Roosevelt delivered the line that would echo across the decades, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Heard now, the words can sound like cliché. Heard then, they cut through a fog of dread. Roosevelt did more than offer reassurance. He framed the crisis as a psychological as well as economic problem. Fear, he suggested, was paralyzing the nation much as polio had once paralyzed him. The remedy, as he saw it, was bold, persistent experimentation. The first 100 days of his presidency became a blur of activity. Congress, still shocked by the scale of the crisis and inclined to support action, passed bill after bill. The Emergency Banking Act to stabilize the banks, the Glass-Steagall Act to separate commercial and investment banking and create federal deposit insurance, the Agricultural Adjustment Act to support farm prices, the Tennessee Valley Authority to electrify and modernize a vast, impoverished region, the National Industrial Recovery Act to coordinate industrial codes and labor standards. The federal government, which had previously touched the average citizen's life in relatively limited ways, began to reach directly into homes, farms, and factories. Roosevelt paired this legislative output with a new kind of presidential communication. His fireside chats over the radio brought his voice, warm, conversational, slightly patrician but unmistakably direct, into kitchens and living rooms. He explained complex laws in plain language, asked for patience, and made people feel that someone in Washington understood what they were going through. At a time when Americans were losing faith in institutions, this mattered enormously. They might not understand every policy, but they felt connected to the man proposing them. The New Deal was not a single, coherent program. It was a series of experiments, some contradictory, driven by a willingness to try, adjust, and sometimes abandon. Agencies sprang up with a flurry of acronyms: CCC, WPA, PWA, NRA, SEC. The Civilian Conservation Corps put young men to work in forests and parks, sending wages back to their families. The Works Progress Administration built roads, bridges, schools, and arts projects, employing millions. The Securities and Exchange Commission regulated the stock market. The Social Security Act, passed in 1935, created a safety net for the elderly, the unemployed, and the disabled, an entirely new federal commitment to income security. These programs did not end the Depression. Full recovery would come only with the mobilization for World War II. But they did something arguably as important. They prevented the collapse of the social order, and they redefined what Americans could expect from their government. Roosevelt insisted that in a modern industrial economy, the old idea of every man standing alone was inadequate. "Necessitous men are not free men," he said, arguing that true liberty required a measure of economic security. The New Deal was not without its critics. Business leaders complained of overregulation, high taxes, and collectivism. Conservatives saw in Roosevelt's activism a dangerous expansion of federal power. Some progressives, meanwhile, thought he had not gone far enough, particularly on issues of racial equality and wealth distribution. The Supreme Court struck down several early New Deal laws as unconstitutional intrusions on states' rights and private contracts. Roosevelt, never one to accept defeat quietly, responded with one of the most controversial moves of his presidency, the Court Packing Plan of 1937. Frustrated that a conservative court majority was blocking legislation he believed essential to the nation's recovery, he proposed adding up to 6 new justices, one for each sitting justice over the age of 70, who did not retire. In theory, this was a structural reform to keep the court's workload manageable. In reality, everyone understood that it was an attempt to create a more sympathetic bench. The plan backfired politically. Many Americans, including some who liked the New Deal, recoiled from what they saw as an attack on the separation of powers. Roosevelt's popularity dipped. Congress balked. The proposal failed. And yet, in a twist of historical irony, the court soon began upholding New Deal measures anyway, and several justices retired during Roosevelt's remaining years, allowing him to reshape the court through conventional appointments. The institutional crisis passed, but the episode exposed the limits of even Roosevelt's personal authority. If the 1930s had brought only economic crisis, the Roosevelt story would still be a monumental domestic drama. But the decade brought something else: the rise of fascist regimes in Europe and Asia, and, ultimately, a global war that would transform the United States from a nation focused inward on recovery to the leading power in a new international order. Through much of the 1930s, Americans were wary of foreign entanglements. Memories of World War I were still raw. Isolationist sentiment ran strong in both parties. Roosevelt, who had seen the dangers of fascism early, moved cautiously, nudging public opinion rather than racing ahead of it. He pressed for military preparedness, supported economic sanctions against aggressor states, and used what leverage he had to aid countries resisting Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. The turning point came not in a speech or a law, but in an explosion of bombs. On December 7, 1941, Japanese forces attacked Pearl Harbor, shattering the American Pacific Fleet and propelling the United States into World War II. Roosevelt's speech the next day, declaring December 7th, a date which will live in infamy, was short, precise, and electrifying. Congress voted overwhelmingly for war. The isolationist arguments that had dominated earlier years evaporated in the face of the attack. From that moment until his death in 1945, Roosevelt became not just a domestic leader, but a wartime commander. He orchestrated the vast mobilization of American industry and manpower, turned auto plants into tank factories, and presided over the creation of the world's largest war machine. He coordinated strategy with Winston Churchill and, more uneasily, with Joseph Stalin. He grappled with questions that would define the post-war world: how to defeat the Axis powers, how to structure the peace, how to prevent a return to the chaos that had followed World War I. At home, the war effort lifted the economy out of depression. Unemployment plunged as millions joined the armed forces or took jobs in defense industries. Women entered factories in unprecedented numbers, symbolized by the iconic image of Rosie the Riveter. African Americans migrated from the rural South to northern and western cities, seeking better jobs and joining a Double V campaign: victory against fascism abroad and victory against racism at home. Roosevelt's administration took some steps toward inclusion, such as banning discrimination in defense industries through an executive order and creating the Fair Employment Practices Committee. But the racial order in the United States remained deeply unjust. One of the darkest decisions of Roosevelt's presidency was the internment of Japanese Americans. In 1942, under pressure from military and political figures on the West Coast, he signed Executive Order 9066, authorizing the forced relocation and incarceration of around 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry, most of them American citizens, from their homes into camps. There was no evidence of widespread disloyalty. The fear was racialized and speculative. The policy inflicted lasting trauma and stripped thousands of their property and livelihoods. In the language of war and security, Roosevelt authorized something that stands today as a clear violation of civil liberties. It remains a stain on his record, a reminder that even leaders who expand freedom in some realms can participate in its restriction in others. As the war turned in the Allies' favor, from the battles of Midway and Stalingrad through the landings in Italy and Normandy, Roosevelt's health, always more fragile than the public knew, began to deteriorate. The strain of long meetings, constant travel, and the burden of command wore on a body still marked by polio and years of smoking. Yet he pressed on. He ran for and won an unprecedented fourth term in 1944, arguing that changing leaders in the middle of a world war was too great a risk. The voters agreed, though by a narrower margin than in earlier landslides. By early 1945, Roosevelt was engaged in the final phase of the war effort and the design of a new international institution that he hoped would prevent future conflicts, the United Nations. He envisioned a post-war world in which the United States would not retreat into isolation but instead take a central role in maintaining global security and promoting economic stability. At the Yalta Conference in February 1945, he met with Churchill and Stalin to discuss the shape of post-war Europe, the fate of Poland, the terms for Soviet entry into the war against Japan, and the structure of the UN Security Council. His performance at Yalta has been debated for decades, praised by some as realistic, condemned by others as too accommodating of Stalin. What is clear is that he was already very ill. On April 12th, 1945, at the Little White House in Warm Springs, Georgia, Roosevelt was sitting for a portrait when he suddenly complained of a terrific headache. He collapsed from a massive cerebral hemorrhage and died a short time later. Word spread quickly, carried over radio waves into kitchens, barracks, and factory floors. For millions of Americans, the news felt like a personal blow. They had never known another president as adults. His voice had been a constant presence through depression and war. The country mourned with a depth that is hard to overstate. Harry S. Truman, his little-known vice president, was sworn in and would soon face decisions about atomic weapons and the post-war order. Roosevelt did not live to see the German surrender in May or the Japanese surrender in August. He died with the outcome of the war all but decided, but the peace still uncertain. What, then, do we make of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, looking back from our own distance? For some, he is the great democratic leader, the man who saved capitalism from its own excesses by regulating it, who expanded the circle of security for ordinary people, who defeated fascism and built the foundations of a more stable international system. For others, he is the architect of an overgrown federal state, the man who centralized power in Washington, flirted with executive overreach, and set precedents that later presidents would exploit. Both views contain truths. The sheer scale of what changed during his time in office makes him impossible to fit neatly into a single category. When he took office in 1933, the idea that the federal government should guarantee a basic old age pension, ensure bank deposits, regulate securities markets, set national labor standards, and manage macroeconomic demand would have sounded radical to many. By the time of his death, these ideas had become embedded in the structure of American life. He did not do this alone. Congress, activists, union leaders, business figures, and ordinary citizens all played their parts. But Roosevelt's gift was to listen, absorb, and then translate shifting social demands into political action. He was not a policy wonk in the modern sense. He delegated details to advisors and brain trust members. His genius lay in steering, in sensing what the public would accept, in framing choices in language that resonated. He could be manipulative. He could be ruthless. He changed positions when circumstances demanded it. Underneath the smile and the jaunty cigarette holder was a cold-eyed political operator. And beneath that, still, was the boy from Hyde Park who had never known the fear of eviction, transformed by disease into a man who could look a coal miner in the eye and say, with conviction, that government would not simply stand aside and watch him starve. The polio that took his legs gave him, ironically, a kind of moral authority he might otherwise have lacked. He understood vulnerability in a way few presidents ever have. He was also a product of his time, constrained by its prejudices and blind spots. He did not dismantle Jim Crow. He compromised with segregationist Southern Democrats to pass New Deal legislation, leaving Black Americans often at the margins of programs theoretically designed for all. Domestic workers and farm laborers, disproportionately Black, were excluded from early Social Security and labor protections. Japanese American internment, already mentioned, stands as another example of the limits of his vision when fear and prejudice surged. Yet even these failures must be measured against the alternative futures that might have unfolded without him. In the early 1930s, other societies faced with economic collapse turned to authoritarianism. Roosevelt's United States, with all its flaws, did not. The New Deal channeled discontent into reform rather than revolution. The war mobilization under his leadership did not produce a permanent dictatorship. It produced, instead, a superpower that, at least in its self-understanding, linked its global role to democratic values. For a listener following this long series of presidential lives, Roosevelt is both culmination and turning point. The earlier presidents in the 20th century, Taft, Wilson, Harding, Coolidge, Hoover, each nudged the country along a path of industrialization and global engagement, but the basic shape of the federal government remained limited. With FDR, the scale changes. The presidency becomes not just an office, but a kind of permanent presence in daily life. Radio carries his voice. Programs carry his name. The federal government becomes an employer, an insurer, a regulator, and, in war, a mobilizer on a level the framers never imagined. In that sense, we are still living in Franklin Roosevelt's political house, even if later generations have remodeled it. Debates today about the scope of social insurance, the role of regulation, the responsibilities of the United States abroad, and the power of the presidency all trace back, in one way or another, to choices made between 1933 and 1945. When people argue about whether government should be big or small, active or restrained, they are often, without naming him, arguing about Roosevelt. He remains, then, a towering, complicated figure, aristocrat and tribune, reformer and pragmatist, defender of democracy and wielder of extraordinary power. He came into office at a moment when fear threatened to paralyze an entire society. He answered that fear not with a single policy, but with an attitude, boldness, experimentation, and the conviction that democratic government could still work. He left office in death after guiding the country through a second, even more terrible crisis. How we judge him depends on which parts of that long story we emphasize. But no one who looks closely can doubt the magnitude of his impact, or the drama of the life that carried him from Springwood to the edge of a world remade.